Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and today I'm pretty ecstatic because I'm going to get the chance to speak with one of my favorite theorists and academics, and I tried to get her on the program a few years ago, and it didn't work out. I think she was a little nervous to be on the show, and I'm so pleased that we're going to have Barbara Smuts on the program. She is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Michigan. She studies social relationships in non-human animals. Her research has specifically looked at primates. She spent a lot of time incorporating herself into baboon societies, for example, and being treated like a baboon. Her research now, though, in particular, focuses on wolves and dogs, and she has a lot of really interesting things to say. So I hope that you will stay tuned and get a chance to hear a little bit from really one of the most, I think, inspiring people that is doing animal work right now. So stay tuned for that. And I wanted to say right off the bat, too, thank you for coming in and teching for me, Susanna. Really appreciate it. I should let people know, too, if you have any questions or comments for us, you can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com, and we're always happy to reply to your emails, although it might take us a little while. We have a Facebook group. You can just go to facebook.com, key in Animal Voices, and join our group, and then you can keep updated about, you know, what we're doing. I think we're going to do some book giveaways soon, so it really pays to join one of those groups, or you can join the mailing list too that we have available on our website, which is animalvoices.ca, and this show will be archived within about a week or so, and we have close to 300 programs that are available for free download by going again to animalvoices.ca. So without further ado, we're going to take a short little musical break, and then we'll come back with Barbara Smuts. Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. That was a little Jeff Healey from the album Songs from the Road, the track Come Together. We are coming together today to speak with Barbara Smuts, Dr. Barbara Smuts, at the University of Michigan in the Department of Psychology. Her field is biopsychology, and we're going to find out what that is about, and her work on social relationships, and she studied non-human animals, and also what non-human animals can tell us about human social relationships as well. In particular, she's looked at primates, wolves, dogs, and she's really a favorite academic of mine, and I was first introduced to her work through the book The Lives of Animals by Nobel literary author J.M. Coetzee, and she had a really moving piece, an essay in the back of that book about an encounter with a baboon that I think will stay with me always. It is my great pleasure and honor to welcome Barb to the show. Hi.
Hi, Lauren. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being on the show. I wanted to start off with giving people a little bit of an introduction to your field. I think that probably for the common layperson, biopsychology is it doesn't roll off the tongue that easily. What is it that you do exactly?
Well, biopsychology refers to biological approaches to understanding behavior, both people who study the brain and behavior, but also people who study the evolution of behavior, which usually involves a focus on the behavior of other animals and making comparisons between different species and between other animals and humans to better understand the origins, the evolutionary origins of the behaviors we see, and also to be able to describe in detail behavior in ways that don't necessarily involve language, so that we can make comparisons across species.
Mm. You've been doing this work for a long time. I don't know if you would say that it was in specifically the field always of biopsychology, but I know that you started studying baboons as early as the mid-1970s.
Yes, that's right. So sometimes I just think of myself as the primatologist, because that's what I did for about 25 years, studying wild non-human primates, chimpanzees, and especially baboons. I spent a number of years observing a large troop of baboons in Kenya. And later in my career, I also spent many months observing same species of baboons in Tanzania at Jane Goodall's facility, Gombe National Park.
How is it that you came to be interested in observing and being with those animals?
Well, it actually started when I was quite young, in junior high school. One of my classes asked us to write a paper, to research a paper the entire semester, like a term paper. And when I got home from school that day, the first account by Jane Goodall of her work with chimpanzees appeared on the cover of National Geographic. So I immediately sat down and read it and was thrilled. I'd loved animals and been fascinated by them since I was a little girl, but it didn't occur to me until that article that this was something that I could grow up and actually do, you know, as a job. So I decided right there and then that that's what I wanted to do. And it took me just about 10 years to the day to get to Tanzania and start doing field work in association with Jane Goodall.
When we were talking briefly on the phone yesterday, you said something that I thought was such a good, probably will end up being the title for this program, actually, about the importance of paying attention to the noise, and that idea is something that informs how you do your research. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. The general approach of scientists, well, I'll just talk about behavioral scientists to narrow it down, is to look at some group, a group of animals or a group of people under particular conditions and record some aspects of their behavior and then describe the general pattern of behavior that characterizes the average individual, say, in the group. And so you'll often see graphs and so on. And those graphs almost always have what we call outliers or variance around the value in the graph itself. And those are individuals who don't fit the general pattern. And they are generally, in sort of standard behavioral research, they are generally considered noise. They sort of get in the way of what is considered the main result and moving forward to better understand that main pattern. But a minority of scientists, including myself, think that that noise is sometimes the most interesting part, particularly if you are interested in behavior, because behavior is a response to other individuals and things in your environment, and we know that different individuals respond in different ways. So I'm interested in the origins of those differences as well as trying to explain the general pattern.
Your approach always strikes me as being incredibly embedded and embodied, and you are somebody that in your research has an incredible amount of humility and opens yourself up to the possibilities that animals might teach you something about yourself, and certainly might teach you something if you can pay attention well enough to how they relate. And the description in the Lives of Animals book where you talk about being a baboon in a way, I think for me that was my first introduction to this different kind of approach. And we had discussed this yesterday that although it's not true right across the board, there's been within some of the behavior studies of animals, there's been this tendency to want to see if they can communicate on our terms, and then that's the way that we will measure their intelligence or their worth, etc. And you and a handful of other people are moving towards the animals to find out more about them, and I was wondering, and in the way they communicate and the way that they know the world, I was wondering if you could introduce us to some of the things that you have learned through that approach.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I think I first became really conscious of that approach when I began my studies with baboons And I had particular questions I was interested in. I was interested in social relationships among adult females and between males and females. And from the literature, I gleaned a number of measures of behavior, things that people had recorded before, like how close a baboon was to somebody else or a particular call that they might give. But when I got to the field, after the baboons got used to me and I was able to observe them from close up, I started seeing things that I'd never read about, both in terms of an individual's actions and also in terms of how they were relating to somebody else. And it occurred to me that, of course, the previous studies could not possibly have understood or comprehended everything about baboons. There was still so much more to learn. And so I deliberately took some time to, as far as possible, empty my mind of any preconceived ideas about who baboons were or what mattered to them, to see if opening to them allowed me to notice things that I might not notice otherwise. If I went in with a very clear, I'm going to look at this and this and this, that then I might not see this other thing that was going on. And during that period of time, which lasted at least a month or 6 weeks, the thing that struck me the most was that over and over again, I would see particular pairs of individuals hanging out together. And I started thinking of them as friends because they were behaving in many of the same ways that humans behave. And I decided that those friendships, particularly between males and females, were going to be the focus of my research. And they had been, people had mentioned these patterns before, but I wanted to study them in much more detail. And I was hoping to understand them as much as possible from the baboon's point of view. What did friendship mean to a baboon? Or what did it mean to lose a friend? How did they go about forming friendships? You know, how you can't, and baboons can't walk up to another baboon and say, hey, you know, want to go out and have a drink and talk about things? They need to say it in non-linguistic ways. And so that became the focus of my work with them.
Even the idea of friendship, I think, for some people, when they think about the animal world, that will get their backs up. You know, that's not friendship, it's evolutionary couples that can blah, 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 or something like that, some way of framing
affiliate,
it.
Affiliated relationship.
Oh, okay, there we go. So you know the language. Why are you dedicated to the idea of friendship? Why does that speak to these relationships more than this affiliated other way of describing?
Well, because it captures what's really going on in a way that the technical jargon does not, and allows people who are hearing about or reading about the research to sort of immediately get a sense, an intuitive sense, of what the researcher is talking about that doesn't follow, I think, from the technical terms. It's interesting, when I first wrote about baboon friendships in the late 70s and early 80s, quite a few people did object to use of that word. But now, many years later, it's actually become a fairly common term in the scientific literature. Some people still put quotes around it, but it's used in at least 20 or 30 different species people have now written about friendships. So, with many of these things where people first object, it's anthropomorphism or it's too subjective or whatever, eventually there's enough scientific evidence supporting a particular perspective that it becomes mainstream. And that finally happened with animal friendships.
So what were a few things that you learned by that close observation of these friendships about those relationships between male and female baboons, for example?
One of the things I learned is when a baboon is forming a friendship with another baboon, particularly when a male is forming a friendship with a female, how important it is that that male go about it in the right way, and understanding what the right way was for baboons was fascinating for me. And it's something that many people can easily identify with, because the males are bigger, twice as big, in fact, as the females. So they can potentially hurt females and their infants. And so females are initially wary of any male that they haven't grown up with, that they don't know well. And males move between troops, whereas females stay in their natal troop. So as males come into the troop, they face the problem of becoming integrated into a society where all the females and most of the juveniles and infants run away from them whenever they approach them, just like they ran away from me when I first got there. And the males who were most successful were the males who were patient and were able to, as soon as the female showed some evidence that she was nervous around him, even if she didn't run away, if she just started fidgeting or looking around kind of furtively, he would stop his approach and sit down and take his gaze off of her. And then if he did that, she would calm down and kind of stay where she was. And then after a few minutes, he might try and move a little bit closer. But each time, paying exquisite attention to how the female was responding and not pushing her, but allowing her responses to guide him in what was acceptable at that point in time. And gradually, over time, she would allow him to get closer and closer. And then finally, she would groom him or he would groom her. And out of that, a friendship might or might not develop. But the first thing he had to do was win the female's sense of acceptance and comfort in his presence. And that could take months and months and months.
You mentioned grooming, and in one of the articles that I read, you talked about, you actually used the expression hanging out. And so I was wondering if you could describe what a friendship looks like. I know that it's variable, but what are some of the characteristics or things that you would say, make a friendship in the baboon world?
The way I defined it was with some very specific measures having to do with how often a given female and male were observed within a couple of meters of one another, and also how often they groomed each other relative to how often they groomed somebody else. So those are very clear, objective measures that other people could use in their studies, and they were sort of an operational definition of friendship. But what interested me most was, once I had defined friendship, was comparing the behavior of pairs who were friends with the behavior between males and females who were not so close, who did not spend so much time together, who were not such good friends. That was the majority of pairwise combinations, of course. And one of the things that was most striking to me was that with your friends, and this goes for female-female friends as well, you can largely dispense with what I think of as baboon protocol. First, I should describe what baboon protocol is. In general, whenever one baboon approaches the other, they don't just march right up to them and start interacting. There's an approach from, and then a pause from a distance of anywhere from a couple of feet to a number of yards. And then if the animal being approached meets the gaze of the one approaching and acknowledges that individual in a non-hostile way by grunting, or they also have a very cute face that they make, which has been called the come hither face, because it signifies, yeah, you can come over and hang out with me. So, in general, baboons go through that sort of protocol, even if it's a little different depending on whether the animal approaching is higher or lower ranking than the one they're approaching. But either way, they have to kind of go through this mutual acknowledgement that an interaction's about to occur. But with a friend, it turns out, you don't have to do that. You can just walk up to them and plop down on the ground next to them and lie down and roll over and expose your belly, which means, please groom me. you don't have to say anything ahead of time. And I just found that fascinating because I think it's such a salient aspect of human friendship and also family relationships. You know, you don't have to be polite to your brothers and sisters in the same way you do to strangers and acquaintances. You can get away with a lot of informality. And the same turns out to be true of baboons and other animals I've watched as well. That friends are, among other things, they're the individuals with whom you can just relax and kind of be yourself and not worry too much about being super polite.
As you studied the intricacies of social relationships with non-human animals, I wonder if you're ever asked about why this is important. And I know that there is a tendency within some aspects of science that we only study animals because it tells us something about us. And I know that's a part of what you do and that it can shed light on human interactions. But I know that you're interested in the animals for their own sake as well. And I was wondering just how you respond to people who ask why spend so much time videotaping dogs, for example, and looking frame by frame by frame, or slow motion analysis of the couples of dogs playing, for example. I know that a lot of your research has focused on play recently. Why study this information?
Well, the first answer usually does say something about the relevance for our own species, just because that's how we tend to think. You know, what does it say about us? But I think it's fascinating to take a phenomenon like friendship or having a baby or having a fight or any of those behaviors and many, many more, to take those behaviors and see how they are expressed in the non-human animal world across many different species. It helps to put our own species in this much larger context so that we're not so focused on, well, what does it all mean for us, but rather seeing the bigger patterns that cut across many species. And then it's easier for us to comprehend that we are, from one perspective, we are just one among many. In fact, from the scientist, quote, objective perspective, we are just one among many. We're just another animal. And from a more, another perspective, I think that studying other animals helps us grasp the process of evolution, how long it has taken for evolution on planet Earth to produce this magnificent array of sort of variations on a theme when we talk about social behavior, the way chimps do it, the way gorillas do it, the way dogs do it, elephants, and so on. I think it enhances our sense of how valuable all these other animal species are, just because they're here and they're fascinating and they have subjective experiences. They enjoy their lives, or they get sad, or they'll miss somebody. You know, they're not just out there in the forest eating and taking care of survival. They're going through a lot of the same things that we go through. And I now think of, you know, the whole world is just animated with these social beings, whether they're tiny little mice or birds or giant elephants. They're all out there having lives that matter to them, and I think they should matter to us.
I think that's a great place to stop for a break. I wanted to come back and talk about your research on play and dogs.
Great.
So we'll take a short break, we'll play a little bit of music, do a station identification, we'll come back with Dr. Barbara Smuts. Please stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Susanna, teching for us today, doing a fabulous job. Thank you again for coming in. Today we are speaking with Dr. Barbara Smuts, and before the break we were hearing her take on why it's important to pay attention to animals and to pay attention to their social relationships, and I wanted to shift the conversation to some of her more recent work on play and dogs. So, Barbara, I know that you've been studying a concept EC, or embodied communication. Could you tell us a little bit about play and embodied communication?
Yeah. Well, I became very interested in dog behavior after I returned from being in the field for many years and was finally able to adopt a dog. And I began to watch my dog playing with, she had a wide variety of friends, and they would come to her yard every day, and they'd play and play, and then they'd sleep, and then they'd wake up, and they'd play and play some more. So with young dogs, play is pretty much what they do when they're awake and active. And so it was natural to begin to understand social relationships in dogs by looking at who played with who and at how they played. And it seemed to me, it was intuitive from watching them, that what was often most important in a play bout in the ways that the dogs were interacting were movements and gestures and glances that were subtle and that were quick and hard to see in real time, hard to see consistently in real time. So I wanted to videotape their interactions and then look at the videotapes in slow motion and frame by frame and so on, in order to get a sense of the second by second nature of their interaction. And one of the many ideas that came to me through those videotapes, I noticed that certain pairs of dogs, when they played, it seemed almost like they were dancing. They were so tuned into one another. The subtlest movement by one was matched with a subtle movement by the other. They might be moving in sync, or more often one animal would do something and then the other animal would respond to that, and there'd be sort of a chain of reaction without pause and without, it seemed like they were at the utmost ease with one another. And it occurred to me that one way to identify very positive relationships in other species was to look to see the extent to which their play interactions or greeting interactions were dance-like in the ways I've just described, smooth and well-coordinated. And then there would be other pairs of dogs, especially when they didn't know each other too well, where you could tell that there was a lot of sort of boundary setting in their play. You know, they'd be playing for a while, and then one animal would get too rough, and the other one would stop playing or screech, you know, a baboon screeches. Hmm. A dog would kind of wail to indicate that they were unhappy with the way the other animal had approached them. And then there'd be a pause, and they'd sort of have to renegotiate, you know. If the dog who was too rough was willing to not play so rough, then they could keep going. But if the dog just wanted to keep playing rough, then that pair, they weren't going to work out too well. They were going to have to go off and each find other dogs to play with, dog who that individual was better matched with. And so, since other animals don't have speech, they are so often communicating with each other just through their bodies. Well, they're always communicating through their bodies, but particularly I'm interested in the way their bodies move in relation to each other, and the timing of their responses to one another, and the patterns that may appear over and over again in their interactions that can give us clues as to the nature of the relationship, why particular dogs might end up being really good friends as opposed to some other pair. And I'm also very interested in how these interactions change over time.
Mm.
So some pairs don't work so well at the beginning, but they keep working at it, and they do eventually become close friends and frequent playmates. So it doesn't always happen right away. It can take some work.
Hmm. One of the things that I thought was so fascinating too was that you had mentioned something that you had observed recently, not only the idea that animals can become closer, but that bonds can be broken as well.
Yes, I observed that quite a lot in the baboons, and that's when I first started thinking about what it was like for them to lose a relationship that they cared about a lot. And having watched my own dogs and their friends very carefully now for over, about 15 years, I've been fortunate enough to witness several close friendships that dissolved or ended, in some cases very abruptly, and other cases where one animal took offense at something the other animal did, and there was a break in the relationship, a cold shoulder that didn't last, where they were able to reestablish the connection after a period of distance. Mm. And the way they respond when something goes wrong in one of these important relationships suggests that they really care about them. They really matter to them. They're invested in them. And they're motivated, usually, to try and maintain these bonds if they possibly can.
You write in a piece that you sent me, The Embodied Communication in Non-Human Animals. You write at the end of that article that relationships with other animals can help us, can help put us in touch with capacities in ourselves that can be hard to reach, caught up as we are in thinking, planning, judging, and communicating through language. Have you found that for yourself, that having these relationships with animals has changed something about how you know yourself?
Yes, it definitely has. It's helped me to feel more at home in my own body and to trust my body to communicate with other beings, whether they be humans or non-humans, to acknowledge the importance of a gesture, of a glance, and kind of trust that form of communication. I found with the baboons that the best way to study them, the way to disrupt them the least, was to interact with them in some of these subtle ways. If a baboon grunted at me in a friendly way, to grunt back a little bit, to acknowledge that gesture from the other individual, rather than just ignore them, which was the sort of standard advice given to people who observe animals. Well, you don't want to interfere with them in any way, so just completely ignore anything that they do that's directed towards you. But in fact, that's rude. It's rude.
They know that you're not a rock, right?
They know that you're not a rock, and you know they've realized that you are a social being like them, even though you're not exactly like them. And they feel much more comfortable after they find out that they can say something to you and you can kind of get it and respond accordingly. Hmm. You know, either by saying hello back or in some cases by moving further away because they've communicated discomfort. That, I think, built trust between me and the baboon. Mm. They weren't worried all the time about, well, what's she going to do now? Because they knew that we could exchange these subtle communications and kind of be on the same page. Mm. And then with the dogs, of course, since one of the interesting things about studying my dogs and their friends is that I am not just witnessing their relationships the way I was with wild animals, but I'm also very much participating in relationships with them all the time. So I'm experiencing those dogs from both the sort of subjective perspective, my own relationships with them, and the more objective scientific perspective. And putting those together is really fascinating for me. I think both perspectives are critical to really understand other sentient beings. I would not emphasize one more than the other, but science, of course, tends to place much more emphasis on the observations and, in fact, to often deny the connection between the human and the animal that they are studying. Mm. And with dogs, that's not possible. You can't deny the relationship if they're your own dog.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be with them. And kind of the observation skills that I developed with the baboons, I think, have just been incredibly useful to help me pay attention to the dogs and what's important to them and what their different signals mean. And I think using my body to communicate with them, not just my speech, has resulted in a closer bond and a greater mutual understanding.
when I taught the third year environmental studies class, it was really an animal studies class a few years ago. At the end of the class, one of my students came up to me and she said, "I really enjoyed your class. You got me thinking about, and now I think about the perspective of my dog." Mm-hmm. And to still say that kind of chokes me up because I feel like, I knew I was successful at that course, because that was about trying to think about that way and to think about those interactions and to think from, although we never fully can do that, to think from the other's perspective, but to try, and that there's so many ways in. And there's an article that you wrote that I think highlights, not only is this kind of, you know, feel good stuff, although it's so wonderful to have enriched relationships, and I think it's better for non-human animals, certainly better for people in terms of our interactions, but that the consequences when we get it wrong or we're not paying attention can be quite severe. And you talk about what would get labeled as like a behavior problem. I think this was in Safi, in one of your dogs, that was behaving in a way that some people were interpreting as aggressive, and that you were told to dominate the dog and that this would be the way to get the animal to submit and behave. Can you talk about that experience in particular? Because I think it kind of gets at this, the interaction between the human social world and our understandings and our values that we can sometimes place, or the we can get really stuck in some rules or ways of making sense of what other animals are doing, and that if we open up to the non-human animal worlds and their social relations, it can challenge maybe some of our rules a little bit.
Yes, I adopted Safi. She's a big black German Shepherd female when she was probably about 8 months old, and our relationship was generally very harmonious from the beginning. She was very easy to train as soon as she understood how I hoped she would behave in a given situation. As soon as she grasped it, she would kind of get with the program. You know, it was just like she wanted to cooperate. She was a great partner. But shortly after I adopted her, there were a few times when she growled at me. And they all involved times when she was on the couch and I sat down next to her and she turned and growled at me. And another time I approached her when she was lying on the floor and she growled. And I just happened to talk to some people in the dog training world who I knew as friends at that time. I happened to mention this to them. And one of the people I talked to said, "Oh, you've got to just nip this in the bud. This means that your dog is trying to dominate you, and if you don't squash this behavior very effectively right now, her attempts to dominate you will become, you know, more and more intense, and you'll have bigger and bigger trouble, and, you know, she might bite you. It's just a really bad sign." And they suggested that I do this thing that is now on some popular TV programs called the Alpha Role, and it's supposedly it's something a high-ranking wolf might interact with a subordinate wolf in a way where the subordinate wolf ends up rolling over on the back and exposing the belly, and that ritual communication among wolves where the one who's on the bottom is acknowledging the higher status of the one on the top. So people have sort of taken this behavior in wolves and tried to sort of translate it whole to the human-dog relationship, where the human, they say, has to act like the alpha wolf in order to maintain control over their dog. And control is really emphasized. So I'd lived with dogs, but I'd never had an experience with a dog of mine growling at me, and so I didn't really know how to respond to this behavior in Safi. And so once I actually tried the alpha role on her, this was about more than 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago, when this sort of forceful dog training was very widespread. It still occurs, but then it was pretty much the only thing going. So I, when she growled at me, I kind of took her body and rolled her over and held her down. And then I looked into her face, and I was supposed to stare at her sternly and hold her down until her body sort of went limp. So supposedly she acknowledging my superior status. But as soon as I looked into her eyes, I let her go because I saw surprise and fear in her eyes. Like, why is this person who I get along with so well suddenly doing this horrible thing to me? And I never tried it again. So instead, I just started paying more and more attention to the situations in which Safi growled or even just kind of looked at me in a way that indicated that she wasn't happy with something I was doing. And it didn't take too long to figure out that it always had to do with me moving toward her quickly and moving very closely toward her quickly. So walking up to her really fast or sitting down next to her on the couch, you know, with a kind of oomph. And it was as if she had some residual fears or concerns about a human moving up to her quickly like that. And I think these were from her former existence, whatever it was. I have no information on what it was, but it became clear over time that she had been hit and that she had been kicked, at least, by people in the past. So she was understandably nervous. And by growling at me, she was saying to me, don't move like that. And so I started approaching her more slowly. I would talk to her from across the room before I started moving toward her. I just tried to avoid those quick, abrupt movements, particularly when she was resting. And as soon as I got that, she stopped growling. And she never tried to, quote-unquote, dominate me in any other way. It wasn't about dominance. It wasn't about control. It was her way, in her language, of communicating to me that she was uncomfortable with something that I was doing. And I think it's really important that our dogs be allowed to communicate with us in their language and that we try and understand what that individual is saying, that particular individual in that particular context, as opposed to saying every time a dog growls at a person, it's because they want to dominate them and the appropriate response is control. Dogs are, there's so much more going on, and they say so much to us with their bodies and their sounds, and I think so much of it just flies right by the average dog owner, and they just don't even notice. And so eventually maybe the dog has to do something, you know, really that you have to notice because nobody's been listening.
We're down to the last 5 minutes. I can't believe how quickly the hour has gone. It's really amazing. I could listen to you talk for hours and hours. It's really amazing work that you've done. I wanted to touch on two things. I wanted to hear a little bit, because the image really sticks with me, about, I think it was this dog licking your face. Uh-huh. And why that was important to allow happen, even though maybe you were a little bit like, ugh, in the beginning. And then just anything that you wanted to share with our listeners before we go out.
No, okay.
4 minutes now we have.
Okay, well, the story about licking my face is from another one of my dogs who was adopted. And she and I bonded, but I felt, for months and months, I felt like there was something missing in our relationship. Like, I couldn't get beyond a certain point in terms of getting close to her. And I didn't know why. And so I started watching her interactions with other dogs very carefully, with the dogs she was really close to. And I noticed that she would run up to them and she would lick their muzzles, and she would keep doing it longer than most other dogs did. And Safi, for instance, the dog I just talked about, would just stand there and let her do this for a long time. And I knew from research on wolves that this muzzle lick and the response of the other animal is a very important component of wolf communication. And basically, the one who licks is saying to the other wolf, do you still like me? Am I still integral to this group? You know, are you with me? And the tolerance by the other animal says yes, basically, to that question. So I thought, well, I'll try that with Bahati. You know, she always wanted to lick my face. I will let her do it as long as she wants to. So we went through a period of time where, you know, me kind of closed-lipped and kind of not enjoying it too much, you know, I'd let her lick my face for a full minute or a minute and a half. And our relationship completely changed within just a few days of me allowing this behavior. She started sleeping right next to me. It was like she was finally got the reassurance she needed.
Yeah.
That she got to stay with this pack. She wasn't going to be exiled again. So again, it was understanding, being able to understand and communicate in their language from their perspective that made all the difference.
Mm.
And I guess that's really what I would end with, that what is so amazing about the animals I've studied and many, many others is their capacity to form close bonds with members of their own species or, under certain conditions, members of different species, as with domesticated animals and humans who have many opportunities to interact. And it's just so enriching and so rewarding to be able to develop mutual trust, a kind of back and forth communication with a being who does not speak human language, but who does communicate all the things that are important to communicate in a close relationship. It's so rewarding, and I just hope that more people will begin to recognize this capacity for social bonds and social communication and really love between humans and individual animals.
Barbara, it was really a great pleasure and an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks. I hope you'll come back on the show sometime.
Oh, I'd love to.
You were listening to Animal Voices, and we were just speaking with Dr. Barbara Smuts from the University of Michigan. Please stay tuned for Dos Mundos coming up, and thank you, Susanna, so much for teching. Take care.